on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening to everybody, and welcome to the Orient Hour this evening on Phoenix 98 FM. I'm Trevor Singfield, and in the studio with me tonight is Steve Jenkins. How are you, Steve?
I'm okay, thank you, Trevor. Yes, all kitted out, me PPE and everything, and ready to go for tonight's show.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Okay, if he's dialed the right number this week, we should have Steve Tongue on the end of the phone line, and he will take you through, as normal, the rest of the show.
Don't
Hello,
panic,
Steve.
Don't panic, here we are. Hello, Trevor. Hello, everyone. At, I suppose what's beginning to look like a crucial period of our season, isn't it? I'm thinking maybe we should end the programme, instead of rocking all over the world, with keep the faith. You know, keep the faith, don't let your love turn to hate. Well, the manager said after defeat at Colchester on Saturday that perspective is important, so we'll try and keep some perspective, as we always do on the Orient Hour. But there are obvious questions to be asked about recent performances, so we will ask them. We'll hear from Ross Embleton about why Danny Johnson didn't start Saturday's game. We'll get Victor's view on that match. And then looking at the broader picture, we have an exclusive interview with Kent Teague talking at length about the frustrations of being so far away, about what his target is for the number of points we should be getting this season, and how we can benefit in the long term when live football does return. And Steve and I will report on the inaugural stakeholders meeting that took place last Friday. Danny Macklin, Nigel Travis are prominent on that one. Talked about everything from how much money we'll get from the agreed rescue package to the lower division clubs to when pilot events might happen and possibly setting up an overseas supporters club. So more of that later. But first, of course, the actual football. Now, four defeats in a row to follow that improved run that we'd had. Only two of them in league games and both by a single goal, you might say. But a loss is a loss. Some are saying Ross is at a loss, actually. A bit of pressure building up there for the manager. So let's look at that Colchester game, and specifically the new formation, a 3-5-2, not really seen, I would say, since back in Justin's time in the Championship season. It was tried at Charlton in midweek with what was virtually a reserve team, and three of that team stayed in the side for Saturday. Jordan Thomas, sort of right wing back, Hector Kyprianou, who'd been man of the match at Charlton, I think everybody agreed, was in midfield. And this was the shocker at Colchester, Louis Dennis, one of the two up front. So we'll come to that particular selection in a minute. But first, Trevor, Steve, the formation. Was it a good time to change, to try something else? Is it a good formation with the players we've got? It was basically, of course, Akinola, Coulson and Happy at the back, Thomas and Brophy, the wing-backs. Then there was a midfield three of Cisse, Hector and Joby, and then Connor Wilkinson and Louis Dennis. What did we think, Trevor, of setting up like that?
Well, first of all, I would say, was it a management decision? Was all the coaches involved in changing the system to this? Who knows? But we're all great in hindsight of things that don't work out in life, and obviously that's probably what happened. But did the coaches get round? Was Sender involved in changing the formation? I mean, the last 20 minutes of the first half, we looked very bright going forward. Thomas was getting in good positions, but the damage was already done by then with the three at the back. With Colchester's rather quick front line, we were found a little bit wanting there. But it come out of nowhere, the 3-5-2 for a lot of us. Sometimes if you're lacking in confidence, maybe the 4-5-1 may have been a better formation. But yeah, it may have been sort of made up on the training ground, the little time they've had, just as a confidence booster. But we didn't really need it after the Bolton win, did we?
No, Steve, what did you think of it as a change from 4-3-3?
Well, I think the main thing is what Trevor's just touched upon after that great win against Bolton. You know, we had a little bit of a run going there, and maybe in some ways it could have been seen that the cup games come along as a bit of a hindrance with the thoughts of perhaps making a few changes. But why make so many, not just in personnel, but obviously in formation? I don't know. It's a very tough call to make, we can only have faith in the management that obviously they consider that very carefully before they made the changes.
Yes, you would have thought it was discussed. I must say, having seen it at Charlton, although we got beaten 3-1, largely through a couple of bad defensive mistakes, I did wonder, having seen that there, whether they might be tempted for Saturday. Just maybe playing devil's advocate a bit, there were a couple of things I thought might be good, that we'd maybe be a bit more solid at the back. Don't forget Josh and Dan Happy both played in a three when Marvin was back there in Justin's last season, and he wanted to get the best players in the team, was why he talked about changing it, wasn't it? So it shouldn't have been new to them. Also, Brophy ought to be a good wing back with his defensive experience he's had now, and young Thomas, as Trevor said there, I think has shown some promise in getting forward. And best of all, I thought it would be Connor Wilkinson and Danny Johnson, for me, the perfect combination to play up front. Wilco, for me, is a natural centre-forward, not a winger. He scored 12 goals, I think, in 20-odd games in a very ordinary Dagenham side. He's good in the air. Trevor, I thought him and DJ up front, him flicking the ball on, maybe DJ to use his pace and get him behind, could have been a good blend.
Well, on my notes in front of me, I've got Dennis over DJ is probably the most baffling team selection of the season. And that's where the discussion probably ends, because, like I said, in hindsight, we can all be great managers. But, I mean, Johnson, I've got guaranteed starters in front of me here. It's obviously the keeper, Joby for the experience, and he drives us forward, and DJ. And I may put Clay in there just for his energy in midfield, but not his passing. So they're the sort of people I want to see starting, and then we build the side around there. Because you've got a fella 9 goals, scoring for fun. You don't leave him on the bench. Incredible.
If I can come in also, please, Steve. Obviously, yeah, we all know that footballers are creatures of habit. They got into the habit of getting good results. The changes were made, and obviously there was a bad result, and it sort of knocked the stuffing out of them a little bit, and then it continued. So then they've got to get back into the momentum, regather what they've lost, and try and regroup and move on from there.
Yep, so it was Louis Dennis, who was Wilco's partner as the front two, really. Let's just remind ourselves this short clip after the game of Ross Embleton explaining why Johnson didn't start.
I said before the game, but I had a chat with Dan before the game, and I'm conscious of the amount of football he's played in recent times, so the last thing we want is to lose him for an extended period. The other side of it as well, Davies, Louis Dennis performed well on Tuesday night. He got a goal, he looked a threat, he made some good runs, he had other chances, so I was pleased with him, and I think there has to be that opportunity for people to get into the team. And as I said, right at the start of the season, it's impossible to play every game.
Well, there you are. Nobody can play every game this season, although Danny Johnson actually hadn't played much more than a few minutes at Charlton on Tuesday. He came on as a very late substitute. Ross was clearly impressed by Louis Dennis in that game at the Valley. He did score a neat goal, as we saw. He also missed a sitter, I think, by the far post in the first half. If he'd got two goals, maybe you could have understood it a bit more. But for me as well, yes, a surprising decision. And the way that the Colchester game panned out, I think we have to agree it proved to be the wrong one. But Louis Dennis generally, what do we think? Last season, a lot of injured spells. I think he had 7 starts, 9 subs. Played a full 90 minutes about once in the league and got 1 goal. What do we think of whether he's going to be a player for us?
Well, I quite like him. I think he's got a role in the squad and in the first team, but the position has to be found for him to make his own. So he's got to really take any opportunity to get by the scruff of the neck, and playing number 9 was not helping him at all. A lot of effort by the coaches and the backroom staff has gone into Dennis to get him out there on the pitch. And I guess they want to run in the team for him to show the potential he's got, because overall he holds the ball quite well and his passes generally find a red shirt and he can beat a man. But the overall thing, he's not a number 9, he's number 10, whatever. The position's got to be found for him, but it's the conundrum they've got, because we've got a lot of good attacking footballers at the football club, and to get them all in the same team and ticking together is a difficult selection for Ross to get round his head to do. But that's the way I see Dennis. I like him, to be honest.
Yeah, Steve, the word that keeps coming back to me really is lightweight, unfortunately, for just physically, apart from anything else. Is that fair?
I don't know about that so much, but as Trevor touched on, you know, we've got some competition for places here, and when the opportunity is given to a player, obviously he's going to go out and do his utmost, no matter what position he's playing in, that he should be used to playing as well, I may add, as he's gone out there and done his best. But certainly I can't see that Dennis would be a number 9, but I'm sure that he'd be as anxious as anybody else to try and push on and make the most of an opportunity should it come his way again in the next match.
And is it reasonable for me to say that Connor Wilkinson basically is a number 9? We talk very easily of Danny Johnson, leading scorer Danny Johnson. He's actually got 9 goals this season. Connor Wilkinson's now on 8, as he somehow got credited with that goal on Saturday, which must have been very nearly offside as well. But that puts him on 8 goals this season. I mean, is it just me? I really see him in that position, not ahead of Johnson, but ideally with him.
Yeah, the partnership there, isn't it, almost there? The goal scored already this season. Him at number 9 and Johnson 10, and go from there. But to say there's reasons why maybe the changes have been made that Ross has already mentioned and obviously has his own reasons for.
Yeah, I'm with you, Steve, of putting him down the middle, because if you've got somebody 6'4" piling into the box and you have got the crosses coming in, he scored with headers. I think he got one at Mansfield or something. And yeah, I would like to see him more central, because in that formation we played Saturday, he was coming deep for the ball. He was in our own half a lot of the time sometimes, because he wasn't getting any service. So they're coming to look for the ball. But yeah, put 2 up top all day long with that. And yeah, them two would be a menace. Big man, little man, isn't it? You know, it's the old-fashioned combination, I suppose.
Yeah, we got to see it, of course, the latter stages of the game when Danny Johnson came on. What was that, 54, 55 minutes or so? But apart from the goal, which I say Wilco has suddenly somehow been given to, it didn't work on the day. Well, we'll talk about the defending in a minute, maybe any positives to come out of Colchester, but let's get another take on it. Dave Victor with Victor's View.
There can be no doubt that Ross Hamilton needs a clear week on the training ground with his players. Up until now, the O's, of course, have faced a relentless schedule with matches every Saturday and Tuesday since the season started. That, coupled with the implications of the COVID outbreak, it's hardly surprising that Orient's head coach has been unable to keep a settled side as he tries to ensure the long-term welfare of his players. The contrast between that impressive 4-match unbeaten run that saw the O's win 3, score 8, concede only 1, to this 4-match losing streak is stark and worrying. At Colchester, we saw the impact that Craig Clay makes to this team. The midfielder, who suffered a hamstring injury against Newport County, was sorely missed. The change of formation did not make up for the loss of energy, determination that Clay provides in the heart of Orient's midfield. We know that we defended the team. On a Saturday, we simply didn't. And the way that the U's were allowed to get behind the O's rear guard must be addressed, as does the defensive errors that have been such a worrying feature of the past 4 matches. A few positives to take from Saturday: Jordan Thomas on his league debut looked promising as he pressed forward, especially in the first half. Lawrence Figueroa again demonstrating his undoubted ability, his saves keeping Orient in the match, and yet again the lads displayed resilience. But Sam Ling's deflected strike in the 88th minute will have provided little consolation for the Orient faithful. It's going to be an important week on the training ground in Chigwell as the coaching team prepare for the visit of Harrogate and Bradford City to Brisbane Road.
Dave Victor there, yes, emphasising the squad really did need that full week on the training ground, didn't they? And good to see, incidentally, that the Port Vale match, I see, has been moved from what was a midweek Tuesday night fixture to the Saturday, when other teams will be involved in the second round of the FA Cup. But that is a little bonus, given that we're out of the Cup, because you get the impression they really could do with these long weeks on the training ground. It's not easy, to be fair, and we know every club is in much the same situation, but Saturday, Tuesday really doesn't allow much preparation time for certainly major changes like the ones we've made. But Trevor, what about those goals that were conceded at Colchester? They weren't pretty, were they? Especially the first one.
Well, yeah, Hector lost his man, didn't he? Let him go past him, and then the fella had about a week to put the ball in the net, so it was just a bit of a bad thing, the three defenders just looking on. But maybe four at the back at the start in hindsight would have been great, because they were tricky up front, and they were pulling us all over the show, Colchester, and we were sort of sitting there waiting for the goal to go in, sort of looking from behind the settee maybe, because it was just a matter of time. I mean, the new formation with the two youngsters, Ankinola and Thomas, I know they would have played against Charlton, but I thought, especially with Hector in there as well, who I think is a great prospect and I like him a lot, and rightly gets man in the match. But he has to be pointed out that he made the mistake for the Newport goal as well. Mm. But youngsters make mistakes, and he's had to learn quick, because he could actually be saving the Orient a lot of money if they go out to look for another Cisse, because he's playing as well as him at the moment, isn't he? The way I can see. So, but I think they may tear this 3-5-2 up, hopefully, and move on. Just a bad week, and it happens.
Yes, I mean, Coulson and Happy, as I said, has some experience of playing in a back three. One of the things about it, probably, is that you've always got a spare man, really. I mean, there's no team that plays with three central strikers, so there should always be some cover for just that sort of moment when it was a striker, wasn't it, Brown, who broke through. As you say, he ran off Hector, who didn't track him back, but nobody immediately came over to him at all. And the second one, unfortunately, young Jordan Thomas couldn't stop the cross going in, which led to the second goal. One occasion, maybe, you wondered if Lawrence Vigouroux might have done a bit better, but, Steve, it wasn't the day to blame him for anything, was it? Because we really owed him a debt on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, he saved quite a few good opportunities there for Colchester to score extra goals. But to say, going right back to the start of the game, the early goal put the O's on the back foot right from the beginning almost. You know, when you're in that bad run, everything is accentuated. All the problems come back to your mind. It's a mental game as well as a physical game. And everything that they had to do and concentrate on was sort of 10 times harder, almost from the opening 15 minutes and so on, you know. So to get that goal back was far too late for the O's, and they would have known that at the time. I'm sure they would never have given up, but they would have been disappointed with their overall performance personally, I'm sure. And I'm confident, obviously, that would have been to the forefront of their minds when they met up for training on the Monday.
Yes, good point about Craig Clay that you and Dave Victor mentioned there. He was missing, and everyone, including Ross, said how much he was missed. Of course, when he comes back in, which we hope will be on Saturday, there isn't room for him and Joby and Hector and Cisse. Who drops out, Trevor?
I think that Hector will drop down to the bench, I'm afraid, but that is just probably on the seniority of the players. Mm. And Cisse is the more established, but he has to now look over his shoulder that he's got a bit of a young pretender coming along. Some of my sort of O's fans and WhatsApp groups are in, don't think Cisse's excelled to what he did at the back end of last season. I think he's done okay. Sometimes if they've got the four in midfield, he's got a bit more responsibility, if Clay's there, and I think he plays quite nicely with Clay in there. So that's what I think would happen, but that's down to Ross, not me.
It looks as though that one defensive holding player, if we're assuming we're only going to have one, is going to come down to Cisse or Hector. And at least for Cisse, he knows there's a bit of a challenge there. And Hector really was, having watched the whole game at the Valley, he really was excellent there. And as you say, he really does look a prospect. Well, we have to ask about the manager too. If you gauge supporters' reaction from social media, Ross has had a pretty bad press this week, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, most managers do when they lose. The stat I would put out at the moment is that there's no wins in November, and what's coming down the road is not actually looking easy on paper. So I know only two league defeats, which is the bread and butter of how the manager should be judged, I think. He may be feeling a little bit hot under the collar, but it's to the people who run the football club upstairs to worry about that. And if you go on social media any time, it's, look, we all got different opinions, and people running polls, should Ross stay, should Ross go? I mean, it's boring. At the end of the day, get behind a fella. He's made mistakes. It's obvious because we've lost football matches. But if you learn from the mistakes, like young Hector will, and a young Ross Embleson will. So I would just hope everybody at the football club gets behind him, because I can't see any change, because we can't be seen as one manager in, one manager out. And in this current financial climate, I don't suppose there's much money to pay people off with. So let's carry on and support the manager in the correct way.
It's just frustration coming through, Trevor, obviously. But I think from a positive point of view, it shows you how much everyone cares. They desperately care for this club after what it's been through in recent years, like, you know. And certainly the fans just don't want to sit there and watch the club going through the motions. However, that may come across incorrectly, because I'm sure the players always give 100%. But, you know, we care so much, and we really want this club to do well. And we just got to get together, as Trevor's saying, get behind the team.
Of course, fair enough. Well, we need some results, that's for certain. We'll come back and look at that towards the end of the programme. But now let's hear from our principal investor and vice chairman, Mr. Kent Teague, about his points target for the season, about how much he's missing us all, and much more. He's been in conversation with Dave Victor.
Hi, Kent.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk to old friends. Not that we're old, but you know what I mean. Friends,
I know exactly.
We've been friends for a long time. You know what, Dave? It feels like we've been friends almost forever. I can't remember a time when I don't feel like I've known you. So it's always good to get the chance to talk to you.
And we miss you, Kent. And it must be so difficult to sort of be so involved with the club, but be so far away physically.
Oh, it's incredibly challenging. You know, it's just so much more fun when we get the chance to be together with Martin and Ross and Danny, the staff, the players, the coaches, everybody, the fans, just walking up and down the high street, you know, hanging out at the Lion and Key, being in the stadium and watching a match together and enjoying most of the match, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's terribly difficult for me to not be in the United Kingdom and not be there. My preference is to, you know, shake a lot of people's hands, hug a few, kiss a few, you know, do all that, tell them that I love them. And so that's really what I wish we could do. And I hope that we can do that sooner rather than later.
Absolutely, Kent. So from a distance, what do you make of the season so far?
I think it's okay. We've talked about this for a number of years. My mark is 1.5 points per game. And I think we've got about 15 points on about 12 games. So we're probably one win, where maybe we lost, and if we had won, we'd have 18 points. So I think it's been okay. I think there have been, you know, signs of really good play, some signs of just absolute brilliance. And there are some concerns that we have in certain positions or in certain, you know, ways that the game is being played. So I think it's been okay, but I don't think it's been terrible. It hadn't been terrible, but I don't think it's been great. And, you know, our table position shows that. When you're right near the middle of the table, then how do you feel about it? Well, I kind of feel middle of the table about it, you know, just sort of middle. So I'm good with it. I'm good with it, but I wish it was better.
How do you, which players have stood out for you so far, Kent?
Well, I normally try to stay away from talking about specific players, but I think that, you know, I think it's hard not to recognize that Vigouroux has played very, very well. And he's only made like one mistake that I remember where he came out a little far and then, you know, they scored. And, anyway, there was some text that I sent that probably Nigel didn't appreciate, but, and then, you know, I think, DJ, you know, his scoring run, you know, he's been playing really, really well, and it's amazing. I'd love to know like his conversion percentage of chances versus goals, because I think it's pretty high. I just personally love the way Cisse plays. He's so calm on the ball. He takes his time. You know, he does all that. I've got so many great relationships with so many of the players that I hesitate to tell you about all. I think about all of them, but I miss them so much. And it's, you know, there's just so many players. I think that Joby is playing really well. I could go through all of them. And again, I think everybody's playing pretty well. I don't see any just absolute disasters in the team. And, you know, there have been some injuries, so we're having to wait for, you know, Hector to get back. I think, not Hector. Hector's back, Kyprianou. You know, but Raul, you know, we're waiting on him to get back. He's an exciting young player. We're really pleased with how he was playing before. So, kind of all over the field, I think we're playing very well or good enough. But all of them need to improve. All of them need to improve for us to get to where we want to go.
It's a season like no other for so many reasons, but not least because it's so congested. I don't ever recall not having a sort of Tuesday off until now. It's quite ridiculous. And then on top of that, the self-isolation and the COVID, it must be so difficult for Ross to keep a similar side and also maintain sort of the players' welfare. How do you think Ross Embleton's doing at the moment, Ken?
I think Ross is doing well. I think there are, you know, there are always, it's really easy. I'm just going to tell you this as a fan and also as a board member. It's really easy for me to sit in the comfort of my chair and second guess Ross and second guess the players. I'm actually very good at it. I can do it. I'm really good at it. I don't publish it as much as some of our fans do, but I'm really good at it. I think I'm really good at it. Nigel tells me that I'm not sometimes, but I think for Ross and I think for the players, I think the motivation is somewhat difficult because they're not being yelled at when they make a mistake. Well, Ross yells at them, but, you know, and they're not rewarded by, you know, fan interaction when they do something great. And so I think that the primary challenge that I sense with the players, even us and on other sides, is they say that the game is just a little flat. It's a little hard to get, you know, once the game is going, you're just sort of going through the motions at times. And there's just a lack of motivation. Now, you probably can sense it better because you're in, you know, in there with them and you can see it. But I think that's the biggest challenge that that Ross has in motivating the players and keeping them going. Let me ask you this, though, Dave. I was going to ask you this about your question. Oh, of the four seasons that we've had, which one hasn't been unusual? I'm just trying to think. You're right. And the first season was unusual because of this, and the second season was unusual because we were at the top of the table for seemingly the whole season. Then the third season, we got the COVID, and then we had to stop and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and Ross and this and that and all that. And then, you know, this season we got, you know, nobody gets to see the matches. We can watch it via stream, which we appreciate everybody that's doing that. But I think every season's unusual, I can't wait for you to ask me, well, you know, are you having a challenge? Because this season is so normal. I can't wait for you to ask me that one time, Dave.
I mean, I'm sure you're right, Ken, but this season's like no other, simply because the Orient faithful, I don't suppose they could ever imagine in their wildest dreams a time when they couldn't actually see the team.
None of us can.
And that must be so hard, because it is such a big part in people's lives. There is a friendship, as you know, and there's family, and there's a tradition. And sometimes when I look at sort of social media after the game, but I don't know about you, Kent, but there's an anger. But I think that anger is about the situation, isn't it? That they want to be together. They want to be at the Brea Group Stadium.
It's interesting. I think that a lack of social interaction around the world causes a heightened level of emotion in all of us, because we miss that interaction, that we are social beings by design. We're designed to be together. We're not designed to all be compartmentalized in a room individually across the world. That's not how we're built. We're social animals. And so I understand the fans, you know, being maybe a little bit more angry and a little bit more concerned and things like that. I'm not as active on Twitter as I was, because Twitter has generally become so toxic, not because of Leighton Orient fans necessarily. But, you know, for me, I'm a little bit more angry, probably. I'm a little bit more on edge. And I feel for them, because I do understand the situation they're going through. I mean, I have basically myself have been self-isolated since March. I don't go out of the house very often, rarely, if at all. My wife and I don't go out very often. And so I completely understand why they would be frustrated. And the other thing, too, that you point to is that they may not completely understand why they are that way. I'm not sure that kids would understand it. I'm not sure if I understand it. So I get it why they might be a little bit more on edge than they have been in the past.
And it must be so difficult for you and the board of directors, particularly those that can't be in E10, to sort of lead and to sort of understand some of the pressures and some of the demands that Ross and the coaching team and others at the club are currently experiencing, because it is such difficult circumstances.
I do think that Nigel and I and Rich have more of an impact on the club when we are in the United Kingdom. I do believe that. I believe that it's very difficult for us or for me to do community service, to go talk to schools, to visit your fine school, to do, you know, the things that we would do, and to interact with the fans, to interact with, you know, our sponsors, and, you know, do all of those things. And I think our interactions with the staff and hopefully, you know, I believe that those interactions with the staff and the players and the coaches and the fans, I believe they make a difference. And so I think there's a little bit of a loss of a feeling of family and a little bit of a loss of feeling of the club, just because we haven't been able to get together and we haven't been able to visit. But right now, there's not really anything we can do about that. We've tried to do some fan forums on YouTube and some other things. But again, they're nothing like going in to the supporters club after a draw and having a conversation with our fans. That's my favorite. I mean, when we have a draw, that's my favorite one to go in there. And, you know, not getting to do that. And it's really tough. I think it's really tough.
I know the players, though, really appreciate the lead that Leighton Orient have taken. And I was talking to Craig Clay recently on the Orient Hour. And, you know, the team meetings that you have and the way in which you get the club together. Orient are taking the lead. They're definitely a side, particularly in League Two, that's showing the way in those sort of things.
Yeah, Nigel has a very strong belief that people who know what's going on and have a little bit better understanding of what's going on in the club, that they perform better. And I agree with him, of course. And so very early on, we started to have player-only meetings with Nigel and I and the board on there with them. And we've had all staff meetings. We had a lot of interactions with Joby and, you know, Dean Brill and, you know, the coaching staff and all that. And we continue to have a lot of that interaction. I just think that it's a good example of how to run a club, and that's what we've always tried to do. I think it makes us a better team. I think it makes us a better side. And I also think that it helps expand the vision of a player so that the player can see that there's, you know, a lot of other things that are going on in the club. And when a player is so isolated as they are today, I think it is important to broaden their vision just so they don't feel quite so isolated.
How difficult is it to have a strategic view at this time? Because I know that when you and Nigel first took over, you were talking about a 5-year plan.
Correct.
How difficult is it to sort of plan ahead, particularly when looking at a number of key players whose contracts I think will finish at the end of this campaign?
Strategically, we think we're on plan. We've suffered and had great success in some ways differently and earlier than we ever anticipated. It's not an excuse, but the situation with Justin is still something that's impacting us today. It's not that it won't ever go away, but it won't ever go away for us, for some of us emotionally, especially. And I think that strategically, it's what's hard is not for us to figure out like where we want to be and when we want to be there. I think what's hard for us is to figure out how we're going to overcome some of these really large setbacks. So as example, there's not going to be as much turnover this year because we don't have fans in the stands and we don't have ticket sales. We have the cards and we're really pleased with how our season ticket card holders have responded to the club. But, you know, there are certain things, there's the short-term metrics that are going on and losses and that sort of thing. But that doesn't mean that we won't be able to achieve and to get to where we want to do it strategically, where we want to be strategically. I think the biggest challenge with the strategic plan is that we were on a growth model of getting more people into the stands, more hype, more, you know, emotion, more enjoyment, more family orientation, and that momentum has been slowed down. And so I think the biggest thing we're going to have to figure out how to overcome is that when we get back to being able to play in front of fans and doing all that, we've got to rebuild that momentum. And all that means to me, Dave, is more days in E10. That's all that means to me. Just a couple more days in E10. All good.
I'm sure you're going to enjoy those as well, Ken. I don't know when it's going to be possible. Let's hope it'll be soon. There's sort of good news regarding vaccines and such like. But the club, we were saying, you know, they've taken the lead in so many ways. There's been so many innovations, you know, in terms of sponsorship and in terms of trying to generate different sources of income. But I would imagine month after month, that must become even harder.
Well, it is very difficult. It is very difficult to, because you don't get to go have a face-to-face meeting with the sponsors, the potential sponsors. You don't. I mean, it's, you know, that makes it more difficult. We are, again, very pleased with the relationship with Harry Kane and, you know, the sponsors that we have. And I think that it's a challenging time, you know, just in general business. It's a challenging time because people are being asked to sell things and they don't get the chance to rely on those face-to-face and, you know, in-person meeting interactions, which makes it a little bit easier. I do think that there will be a resurgence once we're allowed back in the stands and everybody's allowed to be back and be the club again. I think there'll be a resurgence, and I think that Leighton Orient will enjoy a level of support that will make other clubs jealous. I just think that's how it's going to work, because a lot of times, you know, when the pendulum swings one way, when it swings the other way, it's going to swing, and it might swing really hard. And we believe that it's going to swing really hard in our favor in the future.
What about the game itself, Kent? How do you see football in terms of what lessons it might learn as a result of this pandemic, but also the sort of the tensions that there appear to be, both in terms of the ambitions of some of the clubs in the Premier League and clubs in the EFL, not least in League Two?
Well, I think there are some long-term trends in football that are going to have to be overcome. And the massive amount of losses that occur every year in the English pyramid is just not a sustainable model. And so discounting the Premier League, which tends to run at a profit, you know, the rest of us have got to get our houses in order, and we've got to figure out a way to bring ourselves to live with and be okay with, you know, running at break even or, you know, being sustainable. And so I think that's one thing that the pandemic is going to accelerate, this whole idea that we're going to move toward, you know, a break even or a sustainable model. I think the second thing that's going to happen is that because people are going to miss football, I think we're going to find a lot more fans on the other side of this. So I think the pandemic is doing us a great disservice in one way, but I think it's going to do us a great service for the long term of the game. I think there'll be more interest. I think there'll be more people that want to see live, real, emotional entertainment. And that's how I view football. The other thing that the pandemic is doing specifically for Leighton Orient is it is helping us really fine-tune our streaming model, the presentation of the stream, and also our marketing and, you know, sale of the stream. So I think that when we come back, we'll have more fans in the stands than we had before, and I think we'll have more fans watching games than we've ever had before. And so the pandemic is both good and bad. I don't look at it as all bad. It certainly can't be looked at as good in some ways, but I think long-term football is going to be fine because it is such a great sport. It's such a great form of entertainment. And I think it's going to continue to be super accessible.
Finally for me, Kent, I really do appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Can I ask, are there lessons that we should take from the States, particularly in terms of sport? Because there's definitely some sports that we see where there's spectators watching out in the USA.
Well, the problem I have with your question, Dave, is you ask, are there any lessons we should learn from the United States? I'm not too sure how many good lessons we're putting out right now, Dave. I think from a sporting perspective, it is confusing to me personally how there can be a movie theater next door to a football stadium. And there are people going into the movie theater with masks on. And once they sit down in the movie theater, they're allowed to remove their masks so they can eat their popcorn and drink their beverages and, you know, all that. And then they leave the movie theater and they put their masks back on. But in football, where we're outside by and large, and we can get them socially distanced, and we can keep them socially distanced coming in and out of the stadium for the most part, I'm shocked that we're not allowed to have a socially distant masked group of people in the stadiums. I'm just shocked. It just doesn't make sense to me. Medically, it doesn't make sense to me necessarily. And so I don't know if that's learning something from the United States. But I think that all we want is just a fair and equitable enforcement of masks, social distancing, the ability to wash hands, and the ability to do what we do. I think what's interesting, if you look at Leighton Orient specifically, and you look at the Briar Group Stadium specifically, we have four different areas that do not intermingle. They are not allowed to intermingle. They are actually cut off from each other. I can't physically walk from the south stand to the east stand. Can't. Not allowed. Can't go from south to west, west to north, north to east. Not possible. Totally blocked off. So I think that for us, we have a model where we could do it really well because we're already sectioned off. Of course, White Hart Lane and maybe other places in the country, you have a model where people can just go anywhere in the stadium. But for us, we don't have that. So I think we should be considered as one of the ones where we could do it really well. So I just think it's unfortunate that the rules are not, equally applied and that the science is not equally applied.
Well, Kent, it's been a real pleasure catching up. And as I say, I really do appreciate the time. And can I take this opportunity, Kent, not only to say that we're looking forward to seeing you back in E10, let's hope it will be soon. But can I take the opportunity to say thank you, Kent, to you and to the board of directors, because there have been times in these very difficult periods since March that I have felt so proud of Leighton Orient. I mean, I can't remember times when I felt as proud as I was, particularly doing it during the lockdown, the work that the Orient were doing in the community, but particularly the leadership and the innovation that you and the board have enabled. So thank you, Kent.
Well, thank you, Dave. The vast majority of that credit needs to go to Nigel, and it needs to go to Matt Porter, needs to go to, Danny Macklin, and Martin Ling and Ross Embleton. Those are the people that are doing, a lot of work trying to make Leighton Orient something that people value and something that we're proud of. And obviously that's something we've talked about a lot in the past. We really want people who are associated to Leighton Orient, whether they are players or coaches or staff or sponsors or, commentators like you or fans. We want you to be more proud of Leighton Orient tomorrow than you were today, and we hope that you're more proud of Leighton Orient today than you were yesterday. So thank you for those comments, Dave.
There we are, Kent Teague, interesting as ever there, and clearly even more frustrated than the rest of us at present. Kent actually took a bit of a backward seat in the inaugural stakeholder meeting held online last Friday, which is one of the reasons we're so pleased to hear from him at length tonight. But he was present there with Nigel Travis, with Danny Macklin, Martin Ling and others. There were representatives of the Supporters Club and of the three main Orient podcasts. So Steve Jenkins and I were both involved, half a dozen fans too, including disabled fans who were selected to take part. We heard some updates and were then able to join a general question and answer session, as they're hoping to do maybe three times a year. Steve, was it a worthwhile exercise for you?
Oh, it certainly was, and it was great that the Supporters Club were able to assist with one of the questions that came about, visits from supporters from different countries to the ground, and the fact that the club are very, very actively looking to create a database of the fans from around the world. And we said to them that on match days that, it's very rare for a week to go by without someone from abroad coming into the Supporters Club and getting a very warm welcome and then coming back again. Sometimes they're not even host fans. They'll be in London visiting various sites and that, and they've got a loose a couple of hours on a Saturday afternoon, try and get a ticket before a game, maybe at one of the big clubs will find they can't, and come down the O's and they love it. And we get them back again. So that's fantastic.
Yes, could be looking at setting up one overseas members or supporters club, which would be good. The whole hour or so is available on the club website if you want to listen, but there's also a written summary there, which is well done and gives you a very clear idea of what was discussed. Just a couple of main points briefly. The club expect to receive about £400,000 from the rescue package going to League One and League Two clubs, which will be more than welcome. There was an update on when we might get back into the ground. In fact, there's been a bit of an update even today with press reports that supporters could be allowed back next month in areas where there's low COVID infection rates. London, of course, was in Tier 2. I'm sure would need to come back down to Tier 1 to be included in that. And transfer window, supporters always interested in new players. Martin Ling said it was possible we could get one or two players in, not necessarily loans. He thinks there are going to be some bargains out there. So, yes, good exercise. Well done, everybody. Steve, was it you who suggested the possibility of a pre-season friendly with Hearts because of the close connections between the clubs with regard to the First World War? That was a suggestion that came out.
Yeah, I brought that up at the meeting, and it's something that's been building up behind the scenes for quite a while, mainly, would you believe, between the supporters of both clubs. There's a lot of connection with the clubs at supporter level, and with my work in the O's Somme Memorial Fund, we've been looking to encourage that further. We've had representatives go up to Edinburgh last year from the committee of the fund, and were made most welcome. We attended their memorial service and enjoyed a lavish dinner up there, and we was able also to tell the Orient story in detail at the dinner, and have also met up with representatives from Hearts on the Somme itself at their memorial, and then shortly after we went to the O's Memorial in Fleurs. So there's certainly a lot of movement going on behind the scenes. That's how I felt it was very important that the football club were aware of this, and by the sound of things, they're on the case, and hopefully we can get the two clubs closer together at football club level and make it an official connection, hopefully, and with a chance of a game either in Edinburgh or in London.
All right. Very disappointing, obviously, not to be able to visit the memorial, and not next year either. You not got any plans?
Oh, it's been a tough year for me, away from the headlines, as it were. Behind the scenes, it was always planned it was going to go next year. That would have been the 10th anniversary of the sighting of our memorial in Fleur. And I had a waiting list. I had people literally biting my hand off and on the phone all the time. When will we know about the prices? When will we know about the prices? And that was before COVID hit. I was holding it back purposely to try and keep the momentum building up and building up and building up. And then with COVID, I was struggling on trying in the hope that it would all clear, you know, in the summer. Because you have to plan this well a year or so in advance of the actual trip with 200 people going. And I reluctantly made a decision. The coach company were still up for it, would you believe, saying that, yes, we could get a coach half full to take over to the Somme, four of those. And I'm thinking, well, no, because the coaches, when we take over at the Somme, they're chock-a-block. So it ended up being eight half-full coaches over. You can see it just wasn't cost-effective. And reluctantly, I had to cancel it. And even as we speak now, I'm not sure when I'll be able to get back to the Somme tours of the past. But one way or the other, we'll continue to commemorate the O's Fallen and those from other clubs from around the country, I might add, because my research has led to so many other clubs finding out about their own personal club's history. Lots of goodwill being shown to the Orient by the work I've done. And there's something that Kent picked up on a short while ago and stated that he wants people to feel proud about their football club. Well, I've been doing this since the late 1990s, and certainly there's no glory about the whole subject of what I've been in researching, because the Great War wasn't a glorious war. It wasn't for the glorious dead, as it says on the side of the cenotaph. It was an awful war, the last war of innocence, possibly, led by, you know, huge industrial countries pushing their men on to try and take advantage of another country. So without getting involved in the politics, it was the innocent men who thought they was going to go away for a few weeks on an epic journey of adventure, to go on a train for the first time, to go on a boat for the first time, to meet foreign women for the first time en masse, and a few beers or a few glasses of wine in a foreign country sounded very attractive, I'm sure, at the time. And it wasn't until they found themselves on the Somme or in Ypres and similar places facing the thought of going over the top with the blast of the whistle, or being shot by their officer for not going over the top, that they realised how severe things were.
Of course, and we were, of course, able to have a nice ceremony as usual around about the time of Remembrance. Sunday, it was the Newport game before the game. That's always good to see. Now, we're running out of time. We did promise a quick word on the games to come. The Yorkies are coming Saturday and Tuesday. It's Harrogate, newly promoted, sitting just 1 point above us. Bradford City at the moment, 2 points below us, coming next Tuesday. So let's be positive, chaps. Come on, what an opportunity this is.
Yeah, it's a good opportunity. Two home games back-to-back. Yeah, 6 points would be more than welcome. And then it gives, obviously, Ross some breathing space. Pretty confident that we should get something against Harrogate because we've done them in the National League a couple of times, didn't we?
Yeah.
Bradford was the last game that we could have gone, and I ended up in, I can't remember it now, Tadcaster, that was it. We went up to there and had a good day there. But hopefully he goes with his 4-3-3 and goes for the juggler early on, and we can sit down on Saturday and enjoy that. And sadly, I missed the Tuesday night games because I have to drive the cab around London. But hopefully, I'm all positive, we can get something out of it.
Steve, have we got reasons to be cheerful?
Always got reasons to be cheerful, but I'm also a believer that it just needs a break in our favour that would turn the whole fortunes of a game. And, all being well, everyone's going to give 100%. Saint might go in their favour. It will go in the back of the net, and then from then on, the confidence will come flooding back because the players have the ability in the positions that are required of them. And Danny Johnson and the side, we're always going to have a chance of getting a result. That's my thoughts.
I think Danny Johnson will be in the side. I'm not entirely convinced about your 4-3-3 coming back. I wonder if they've been working on the training ground this week on that back three and getting those wing-backs forward. What about the... Trevor, you said, actually, that it's still a very tight league, isn't it? And especially with 12 games played.
Yeah, in my notes earlier, there is no outstanding team in this football league too. Not at all. I mean, the way I look at it at the moment, there may be teams that are better organised than Leighton Orient at the moment, but I feel if we go toe-to-toe, really offensive, we can cause damage to a lot of these things because of the amount of goal scorers we've got in the side at the moment. So start keeping a few clean sheets and who knows.
Well, let's hope so. Fingers crossed. Listen, it's time to go. It's time for me to say thank you to Trevor Sinfield, to Steve Jenkins, to Dave Victor for his interviews, to producer Andy Gilson, Karen Harrison for getting the podcast up, and thanks very much to you for listening. Keep the faith and up the oath.
on the hour across Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM News.